Hey, this is The Takeaway for Thursday, February 22nd, 2018. If you like this podcast, go and subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. That means you'll get it every day. And leave us a good rating if you will. That means we'll keep making it every day. Thanks.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
I don't understand. I turned 18 the day after. Woke up to the news that my best friend was gone.
It's been 8 days since 17 people were killed in a mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida.
And I don't understand why I could still go in a store and buy a weapon of war, an AR. How do we not stop this after Columbine, after Sandy Hook? I'm sitting with a mother that lost her son. It's still happening.
On Wednesday, from a listening session with President Donald Trump at the White House to a CNN town hall in Tallahassee, Florida, students and parents pleaded to the president and politicians on live television to do something.
It doesn't make sense. Fix it. It should have been one school shooting, and we should have fixed it. And I'm pissed, because my daughter I'm not going to see again. She's not here. She's at King David Cemetery. That's where I go to see my kid now.
I was shot twice. I was grazed on my back and ricocheted on my chest. My best friend was killed right in front of me. And the experience that I had can never be taken away from me, no matter how much I want it to be. What are you going to do to strengthen background checks to prevent another tragedy like this from occurring again?
Senator Rubio, can you tell me right now that you will not accept a single donation from the NRA in the future?
So, number one, the positions I hold on these issues of the Second Amendment, I've held since the day I entered office in the city of West Miami as an elected official. Number two, no, the answer to the question is that people buy into my agenda. And I do support the Second Amendment. And I also support the right of you and everyone here to be able to go to school and be safe. And I do support any law that would keep guns out of the hands of a deranged killer. And that's why I support the things that I have stood for and fought for during my time here.
More NRA money? More NRA money?
That is the wrong way to look. First of all, the answer is people buy into my agenda.
You can say no.
Number second, well, if people want to support my agenda, they're welcome to do so, but they buy into my ideas. I don't buy into theirs.
Okay, so I knew that was going to happen. NRA, please just keep the money out of Rubio, okay? If he wants to run again, you guys can.
Thank you, Cameron. Appreciate it.
When I had those hundreds of terrified children that were running at me, my question to that is, am I supposed to get extra training now to serve and protect on top of educate these children on how to be these eloquent speakers that are coming up and presenting issues to you? I mean, am I supposed to have a Kevlar vest? Am I supposed to strap it to my leg or put it in my desk? How am I supposed to go on that way?
Well, first, I don't support that.
And after Sandy Hook, they said, we wouldn't let this happen again, and yet it has continued to happen for 5 years. How many more deaths can we take as a country? How many more teenagers and 6- and 7-year-olds can we allow to die? Don't let that happen anymore on your watch.
The calls for some kind of action kept coming. President Trump tweeted this morning, "I will strongly be pushing comprehensive background checks with an emphasis on mental health, raise the age to 21, and end sale of bump stocks. Congress is in the mood to finally do something on this issue. I hope." It's impossible to know exactly what the president means there or if he'll stick to that position. Meanwhile, Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio told the CNN crowd that he might be willing to shift his stance on guns in some cases.
And I'm glad you asked that question, because I traditionally have not supported looking at magazine clip size. And after this and some of the details I've learned about it, I'm reconsidering that position, and I'll tell you why. Because while it may not prevent an attack, it may save lives in an attack.
But what does the American public think when another deadly shooting claims the lives of innocent Americans, this time, again, many of them children? We asked you to call us and tell us what changes in gun policy you would support, but did desperate cries for lawmakers to do something mean that something would be effective. Today, we want to look at what the broad range of gun proposals out there would actually accomplish, whether they've been tried before or could be tried again. Is there a political and a public appetite? And could they actually be effective in stopping attacks like the one at Parkland last week? Lois Beckett is here. She's senior reporter for The Guardian U.S. covering guns and gun violence. Lois, welcome to The Takeaway.
Great to talk with you.
Well, Lois, let's start with bump stocks, because the president himself said this week after Parkland that he was ordering the Justice Department to look at ways to regulate bump stocks, presumably making them effectively illegal. Now, the Las Vegas shooting happened back in October when a bump stock was used. It's now in February when the president proposed this change, but there seems like there's some support among Republicans in Congress. So here's Tom Cole of Oklahoma.
Anytime you've got a technology that takes something that's legal and turns it into something that's illegal, because automatic weapons in private hands are illegal, then I think you've got to look at it pretty carefully.
Lois, bump stocks, they attach to a semi-automatic weapon, effectively making it an automatic weapon. Are we on the verge of an actual ban here?
The important thing to realize is that bump stocks are a weird toy for gun nuts. They have no self-defense purpose. Mostly before the Las Vegas shooting, they were known as something that gun enthusiasts would use in YouTube videos and be like, oh, I tried this crazy thing. It made my gun fire really fast. It's really inaccurate. There's no real purpose to this other than to sort of have fun and make a dumb video. So the fact that we're considering banning a weird toy after it was used in the deadliest mass shooting in contemporary American history, that's just a really low bar. There's not a big constituency for these things. It is true that tens of thousands of Americans actually wrote into the Justice Department to oppose these devices being banned, because there are a lot of people who do not think it's right to ban anything that was just misused once in a crime. But for legislators or even for the NRA, there's not really any reason to fight for these things.
And what do we know about what the effect would be on safety? Las Vegas is one high-profile case where a bump stock was used. Would it make people safer if they went away?
I don't know of any other case in which these devices were used in a crime. It's certainly possible that if they're not banned, or even if they are, because a lot of people have already bought them, that someone else will use it in a horrific crime. That's certainly possible. But banning them doesn't really make us safer. It just maybe stops things from getting even worse in the future.
Well, Lois, let's hit on another policy that the president has mentioned over the last couple of days. Arming teachers. The president mentioned during the listening session at the White House on Wednesday that he might be in favor of allowing teachers to carry concealed weapons in classrooms.
It would be, it's called concealed carry, where a teacher would have a concealed gun on them. They'd go for special training, and they would be there, and you would no longer have a gun-free zone. Gun-free zone to a maniac, because they're all cowards. A gun-free zone is let's go in and let's attack, because bullets aren't coming back at us.
It's controversial, but do we have any idea of what it would take in schools across America to enact this policy and what it would accomplish?
I think the hard bar here is teachers themselves, who have made it very clear that many of them do not want to be armed, do not think that this is appropriate. Since Sandy Hook and even before that, schools have been able to make their own choices in many cases about what plans they want to take. There are 8 states where K-12 schools can have people with concealed carry licenses in schools if they deem that appropriate. But the idea of the federal government trying to force local schools to have guns in the classrooms, that's not going to fly.
Well, Lois, let's talk about the assault weapons ban. It's been on the books before. We've seen the AR-15 infamously used in so many attacks over the last couple of years. There was an assault weapons ban in this country for 10 years from 1994 to 2014. So we have some data on how it worked, if it worked, did it?
So here's the hard thing, which is that assault weapons, especially these military style rifles that have become the gun of choice for mass shooters, they're just not used that much in overall gun violence. Rifles of any kind are used in gun murders about 3.5% of the time. So when evaluators looked at the decade-long federal assault weapon ban, they first just looked to say, you know, how often were these guns used beforehand, and then how often were they used after? And the bigger picture is that it was going to be hard to have a big effect no matter how successful the ban was, because you're just not starting with a very large number. And what the evaluation concluded, the Department of Justice funded most rigorous evaluation, was that there was no clear evidence that the ban had had any impact on the reduction of violence that happened from 1994 to 2004, and that a renewed ban, even a significantly tougher one, would have effects that were small at best and perhaps too small for reliable measurement. That's the words of the study's lead author.
Small at best and unreliable, and still let's put ourselves in the middle of Congress if support built amongst the public even higher than it already is, 70%.
Well, I think
for an assault weapons ban, could it pass?
I think if you listen to the students and the parents last night at CNN's town hall in Florida, they don't care if these rifles aren't used in the majority of shootings in America. They think it is an atrocity that they are used in even one. And I think that's the essence of the political moment we're seeing right now, is that gun rights advocates have made arguments for a long time that, oh, this wouldn't be that effective, or, oh, that doesn't make that much difference. And a parent whose daughter was gunned down in her school hallway who said these kids were hunted like they were animals, they don't want that gun anywhere in America. And to say it might only have a 1% reduction on overall gun violence in America, they're going to say, great, let's start there and then let's see how much further we can go.
Lois, when you talk about the grim math of some of this violence, the number of people injured, the number of people dead, sometimes you talk about the number of bullets that an assailant can fire in any given assault. The issue of assault weapons always brings about the issue of high-capacity clips. There have been calls in Congress to limit the size of these clips. 10 states do have some limits on the size of clips, so do we have any comparative data about how well that works?
So if you ask experts about the assault weapon ban, they're going to tell you really quickly that the most functional part, the part that really matters, is the size of the magazine, because that's the what determines how fast a shooter can fire and how many rounds they can fire before they have to pause very quickly to reload. If you talk to gun rights advocates, they're going to say, listen, if you're practiced at all, reloading a magazine doesn't take that long. And also, if you can sort of are handy at all, you can basically make an extended magazine pretty easily. And those things are true. But we're talking about parents who think, you know, if my child had had a couple seconds while a shooter who was attacking my kid in school had to reload, like maybe my kid could have run out of that classroom. And what we heard that was so striking with Senator Marco Rubio last night is he said, I have some information that's not yet public about the Parkland shooting that suggests that actually magazine limits would have made a difference in the shooting, that some people might be still alive if the shooter had not had magazines and not been able to fire so many rounds so quickly. And he said that he was thinking seriously about endorsing limits on magazines. So what's really crucial here is people always think about the gun itself. They think about the rifle, the bristling black rifle, but the magazines, those can be used on handguns too. And there's a lot of people who are not so excited about trying to actually ban rifles who might get behind a ban on high capacity magazines.
Lois, listen to David here.
Hey, this is David from New York City. I'm concerned that if we get an assault weapons ban, that's going to be almost like a red herring and we'll have fatigue and not get the other reforms we need. I am all for a national gun registry, which is the number one boogeyman that gun rights activists fear.
Lois, David says an assault weapons ban would be fine, but a national gun registry where you can track every gun that's legally purchased and know who took that gun out of the store, that would be an effective policy.
So having a federal gun registry is actually something that's been popular with Americans for a long time. In surveys, you see 60-70% of people, so that means a bipartisan group, saying, yeah, I think that's a good idea. It's actually illegal under federal law for the federal government to have a registry of everyone's guns or to use the data from the nation's gun sale background check system in any way to assemble that. And that's because gun rights advocates care a lot about their privacy and they're very skeptical of the government and are worried about guns being banned and then confiscated. So it's a really interesting, again, divide where public opinion is very strongly in favor of this. But when President Obama was asked in 2016 about possibly registering guns or treating them like cars so they would have a title and you could sort of track how guns passed hand to hand, Obama said, you know, there's just really not support for this. And yet the polls show actually there is. So I think the question we're having today is that Democrats who have been in Congress for a long time and other Democratic leaders have a clear idea of what's possible and what's not. And we have a bunch of teenagers who just don't care what's possible and what's not. They've decided what they want and they're going to fight for it.
Well, Lois, let's go back to the point of purchase for weapons in America. Take a listen to Kevin here.
Yes, Kevin, Manchester, New Hampshire. I am an NRA member. I would support a three-day waiting period.
Kevin supports a three-day waiting period before you can take a gun out of the store. Are there waiting periods on the books now?
A handful of states have waiting periods ranging from anything from 12 to 24 hours to 14 days. And they are a policy that a lot of people say this makes sense, especially for suicide. There's some suggestion from an early study of the 1993 Brady Law that waiting periods might reduce gun suicide somewhat, but we don't have a lot of really clear data on it.
Well, Lois, let's talk about mental illness and the prospect of mentally ill people acquiring guns. Republicans in this debate, especially over the last couple of years, have really attached to the idea of keeping guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them because of mental illness. Dana Loesch, who was representing the NRA at the CNN town hall, of course, referred to them as nuts and crazy people who shouldn't have guns. How far could a policy like this go? How could it be implemented? I mean, one key question here is how many shootings are perpetrated by people with identifiable mental disorders in the first place?
If you look at overall violence, the best estimate that we have from mental health and violence researchers is that if you magically cured all very serious mental illness, so serious depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, that you would only reduce the total amount of violence in the United States by about 4%. If you look at really extreme mass shootings, sometimes those percentages are a little bit higher depending on how you define the different incidents. But the bigger picture here is that whenever there's a shooting like this, we blame mental illness and we put tremendous stigma on mental health, which is actually really counterproductive. When we're talking about homicide, we're often talking about people who are angry or people who are coming from intense deprivation. There's a study that looked at people even with serious mental illness, and if they hadn't been exposed to violence themselves, then they weren't particularly more likely than anyone else to be violent. So that's one really important thing. And the other thing is that actually if you're trying to understand at what moment someone becomes dangerous and at what moment there's enough evidence of that that you could by law take away their Second Amendment rights, those two things don't line up. A lot of the times that people are most risky if something serious is happening to them is before that there are enough signs that the government can come in and take away their guns. So that's why one of the most promising policies here are these red flag laws or gun violence restraining orders. And the idea here is that the government doesn't really know what's going on with people in moments of extreme risk, but their family members do, and law enforcement officials see that. We certainly, there's evidence of that with the Parkland shooter. And so why not give them the power to petition a court to say, this person is at real risk right now. They shouldn't be allowed to buy guns. If they already own guns, they should be taken away, and have that be temporary. So instead of saying, here is a person, we're going to classify them as mentally ill for the rest of their life and take away their gun rights, it's here's someone who is at a moment of extreme risk. It is not safe for them to have a gun. Let's take that away temporarily, and then they'll get their rights back later. So more flexible, faster. And this is something that some conservatives have said that they might be able to support, and that has really strong support from gun violence prevention organizations and from folks like Nicole Hockley, who lost her son in the Sandy Hook shooting. Pretty much everyone is agreeing that these laws might be a good idea.
So, Lois, let's try to get to some bottom lines here, because there are so many policies on offer out there, and very little has been done on any level, especially in Washington, on this issue. Here's a main question for me. What's the most effective policy proposal that Americans say they support?
I think if you look at the intersection of what has support and what actually has data behind it that it will make a real difference, then these gun violence restraining orders, these extreme risk protection orders, they have all of that. And the most important thing about them is that they're actually a policy that's relevant both to mass shootings and to gun suicide, which represents two-thirds of all gun deaths in the United States each year, 20,000 people lost. That's what's really hard about this issue. is that public opinion or the things that we instinctively think should work or might be really good don't always work. They're not always that effective, and that's in part because our perception of what violence looks like in America, what gun violence looks like, doesn't actually often line up with the facts. And so these red flag laws in this moment might be something that you could see real action on, but it's also certainly true that what might push those through is the activism by students and parents who are saying, we want to ban assault weapons. Maybe we want to ban all semi-automatic rifles. We want to do what it takes. The gun control movement has been sort of compromising in advance for many years now. And it'll be interesting to see what they can get when they stop compromising at all.
Lois Beckett, thanks so much for stopping by to talk to us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Lois Beckett, senior reporter for The Guardian U.S. Let's go to the state of Missouri now. The state has executed 17 people since 2014 using the drug pentobarbital. Well, now an investigation from BuzzFeed News finds that state officials in Missouri went to great lengths to keep the supplier of that drug a secret. The pharmacy company is called Foundation Care, and it's been under scrutiny from the FDA. With me now is Chris McDaniel, investigative reporter for BuzzFeed News. Hi, Chris.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, Chris, your report, you uncovered the considerable efforts that the state of Missouri went through to keep the identity of Foundation Care secret, supplying the state with pentobarbital, a controversial execution drug. Tell me some of that story.
Yeah, it was not an easy story to find out what they were hiding. They had basically the number two guy in the Department of Corrections in order to get the drugs from this pharmacy. They had them meet up at a location, and he would hand over an envelope full of cash. And that's how they would pay for the drugs. And it was like $7,000 per execution. The pharmacy had a code name, and that was the only way it was referred to. The code name was M7. Only a few people within the State Department of Corrections knew its identity. The attorney who was representing the Department of Corrections didn't even know the identity of it.
Well, we'll talk about Foundation Care, this company, in just a second. But look, these execution drugs have become very controversial, not only in Missouri, in other states, moratorium on its use in death penalty programs all over the country. But why all the secrecy here? Why such great lengths to protect the identity of this company?
You know, the reputable drug suppliers don't really want to participate in executions. It's bad for business, and they oppose it either for business reasons or for moral reasons. It's led states to turn to some pretty questionable sources that both the source and the state don't really want to be associated with each other, as was the case here. And, you know, what happens is after they get exposed, they decide, okay, well, we won't sell for executions any longer, which is probably what's going to happen here. And it's what's happened to other suppliers when they get outed. And so that's why states are most concerned about it.
Well, Foundation Care, the company itself, who are they?
So Foundation Care is a compounding pharmacy located in the suburbs of St. Louis. It's been around since 2004. It caters mostly to cystic fibrosis patients. And compounding pharmacies, they mix drugs for specific needs of specific patients. They're regulated mostly by states and not by the FDA. And the drugs that they make have a significantly higher failure rate than manufactured drugs. This specific pharmacy has a lot of regulatory findings that are not great. The FDA inspected them in 2007 after a cystic fibrosis patient developed pneumonia after drugs that she took, she alleged, became toxic. That person ended up suing Foundation Care, and they settled out of court after she passed away. The FDA found numerous things that they said could put patients at risk. When the FDA came back in 2013 to inspect the pharmacy because they deemed it high risk, the head pharmacist standing outside of the pharmacy tried to refuse them entry into the pharmacy. Eventually, after arguing, they were allowed in. They found a lot of problems again. They told the head pharmacist what they found, and his response was to threaten the FDA. He said that if they publish their findings, he'll come at them with a vengeance, everyone involved.
So what kind of picture does this paint for you, Chris? This is a pharmacy, a compounding pharmacy that's clearly fallen under scrutiny with the FDA. A lot of other compounding pharmacies, more reputable ones perhaps, you've said, don't want to do business in capital punishment. Is this a question of the state of Missouri kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel here for a supplier?
It's definitely the case. And I have to say, I'm not too surprised by it. I've been reporting on the death penalty for several years. And they almost never go to a good supplier. And the reason for that is because, you know, why would you get involved in executions? You know, this pharmacy made about $135,000 selling execution drugs, which may sound like a lot, but it's really not compared to the other business that this pharmacy is doing. You know, now their name is out there. Their regulatory history is dredged up. The lawsuits that have been brought against them by former employees and by patients is now out there. It just doesn't make sense for a lot of reputable ones. This one in particular was doing so seemingly for ideological reasons. The head pharmacist refused to talk to me, but under an affidavit that the pharmacy wrote under a pseudonym, it said that they did so because they believe in the death penalty and think that they have a First Amendment right to sell these drugs.
So other pharmacies have fled this business because of the political or moral implications, and Foundation Care, it seems the opposite, has flocked to this business.
Right.
Is there any evidence that they are the supplier for other states that are still pursuing pentobarbital?
You know, that's a really good question, and that's one that I would like to find out the answer to, but I do not know at this time. There are a couple of other states that use pentobarbital as well, like Texas and Georgia, and they have also been carrying out a lot of executions during this time period. But it's right now totally unknown if Foundation Care is supplied to any other states.
Well, look, there are moratoria on executions in many other states. Missouri is not one of them. In fact, they're charging forward with a whole long list, more than a dozen and a half executions, as we mentioned. Is there any indication that these revelations and sort of the cloak and dagger methods they're using to obtain these drugs are going to have any effect on the state's use of the death penalty overall?
After we published our story, the corporation that bought this pharmacy said that they will no longer sell drugs for executions. But Missouri has already amassed a pretty considerable stockpile, you know, from this pharmacy. So they have enough to carry out several executions. I would not be surprised if either the state or this pharmacy faces a lawsuit. That's what happened when we identified the previous one, which also had a lot of problems.
Secret payments and secret identities in Missouri's pursuit of pentobarbital, an execution drug that has become controversial the nation over, at least in states that do have the death penalty. Chris McDaniel is investigative reporter for BuzzFeed News, who unveiled the identity of that company, Foundation Care, supplying drugs to the state of Missouri. Chris, great report. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and we have more now from our continuing coverage of the opioid crisis in America. Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid that's 50 to 100 times more powerful than morphine. It's potent, and it's also deadly. In fact, the CDC connects fentanyl and other synthetic opioids to about a third of the 64,000 overdose deaths in the United States in 2016. As dangerous as fentanyl is, often drug users don't know that it's mixed into a drug they're about to inject, but there is a way they can find out.
This is a test strip that tests for fentanyl. If you had a little bit of the drug, you could pop in here. You would add a little bit of water, and then you use this test strip, hold it in, and if there was fentanyl present, two red lines or pink lines would appear.
You're listening to Mark Townsend there demonstrating the use of a test strip that can detect the presence of fentanyl in heroin. Mark works for a needle exchange program in New York City, and his team regularly distributes these test strips to the community there.
People have come to me and said, well, I tested and it was positive, but people are in such desperate straits, they would even use this even if it tests positive, pretty much.
So once somebody finds out that their sample of drugs contains dangerous fentanyl, what do they do next? And how important a tool are these test strips in the face of the opioid crisis in this country? I put that question to Leo Beletsky. He's Associate Professor of Law and Health Sciences at Northeastern University.
So what these test strips do is essentially provide a yes or no answer. So they cannot tell you how much fentanyl is in a specific sample, but they can provide essentially an answer to the question, does this sample have fentanyl in it? And recent research out of Johns Hopkins and Brown University called the Forecast Study suggests that the fentanyl testing strips are actually pretty good at answering that question.
So then how exactly are the strips meant to be used in the real world? We just heard Mark Townsend at the top there say that even when a test strip says, yes, there's fentanyl in this sample, a lot of people are desperate and they will use anyway. So if a drug user uses a strip and it detects fentanyl, what's next?
The optimal response would be for the person to not use a sample of drugs that has fentanyl mixed in it. But if they're going to use it, there are specific steps they can take to reduce their risk. The New York City Department of Health had a big information push about this about a year ago. Those tips are essentially don't use alone, do the drug slowly, make sure that naloxone is close at hand because fentanyl-related overdose is much more rapid onset, so it can happen within minutes versus heroin-related overdose typically takes from 30 to 60 to even 90 minutes.
Leo, do we have any sense of how well these strips have prevented overdoses in places where they are being used, like in New York?
We do not. This is a relatively new intervention, a relatively new tool for harm reduction programs. And I think that, you know, much more research needs to be done. And also, you know, this is a relatively blunt tool. I think going forward, it would be great to deploy better technology to be able to test for how much fentanyl is in the supply. And also, I think it's important to note that the use of testing technology is something that can be deployed by public health folks as well to monitor on a broader level what the supply looks like and where it's changing and where fentanyl is really being concentrated in the supply so that we can deploy public health resources. So there are other uses of drug testing or drug checking technology that are important.
So Leo, we're a little short on data because test strips are relatively new on the scene. So I'll ask you what your feeling is, your professional feeling about how big a role these could play in curbing at least some opioid overdose deaths in this country.
Todd, I think in some ways the testing strips, they facilitate a conversation and they facilitate a risk reduction messaging strategy. I think that in and of themselves, their use is really going to be magnified what people should be doing to reduce their risk in ways that we discussed.
Leo Beletsky, Associate Professor of Law and Health Sciences at Northeastern University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Todd.
The Pennsylvania Supreme Court redrew that state's congressional map earlier this week. And when they did it, they got help from one particular man, Nate Persily.
Ultimately, the map writing comes down to one person, Professor Persily from California.
That's the voice of Drew Crompton. He's the lead attorney representing Republicans in Pennsylvania State Senate. We spoke to Drew on our program on Friday when we did a deep dive into gerrymandering.
Most of my people are incredibly frustrated by, one, the fact that the Supreme Court thinks they have this right, and two, that not only do they think they have this right, but they're going to turn it over to a professor from California to determine which congressional districts we have in Pennsylvania. People find that incredibly offensive. I find it offensive.
The Pennsylvania map might be more competitive for Democrats now after the redraw, but it's not the first time that an outside consultant has been called in to fix a state for gerrymandering or a redistricting mess. Justin Levitt is a professor at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles and a redistricting expert himself. Professor, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Professor Levitt, Nate Persily has been on this show several times talking about gerrymandering. Remind listeners of his background and why the Pennsylvania Supreme Court picked him to help redraw their congressional maps after this long fight.
I think the Pennsylvania Supreme Court picked him to help them, and that's exactly the right word, in part because he is so solidly bipartisan and neutral in his background, and in part because he's so solidly accomplished in his experience. He was picked to help at least five other courts, actually six other courts, including one just a few years ago, draw their own lines in jurisdictions as varied as New York and Maryland, Georgia, Connecticut. He was also picked by the Democrats' top lawyer and the Republicans' top lawyer, a very bipartisan pick, when they needed someone to call on as their research director for a bipartisan commission on election administration in 2013. I'll also say that Nate started his career at the University of Pennsylvania, so to call him a California law professor ignores the fact that he's got some pretty deep roots in the state.
This is an enormous amount of power, to be fair, resting in the hands of one person, isn't it?
Well, it's an enormous amount of power resting in the hands of the court, but it's the power that we give them. The Pennsylvania State Supreme Court was interpreting the Pennsylvania State Constitution, and if the legislature doesn't like that, they really have to look to the Pennsylvania State Constitution to blame. The Pennsylvania State Supreme Court asked for assistance. I don't think they simply turned over the keys and let Nate drive away with them.
And what does that assistance look like when it gets down to it? What does his assistance really look like when he's suggesting to the court how to draw lines?
He's actually drawing the lines on a map using software that allows you to draw the lines on a map that helps you keep track of how many people are in each district, first and foremost, because the districts have to be roughly equally populated. That helps him keep track of the racial composition where that's relevant, where the Voting Rights Act actually implies an obligation to draw the district in a particular way. And beyond that, he's following county lines, he's following municipal lines, he's abiding by the criteria that the court set. That can be tricky in some circumstances.
Your take on Pennsylvania's new map?
My take is that it's certainly more fair and equitable than the map that was originally drawn at the beginning of the cycle, which is the point. The map that the court drew is much more regular. It abides by the criteria that they laid out, the fact that the districts would be compact, that they would be contiguous, that they would follow other political boundaries like city and county lines. And in the process, it helps create a more competitive election field rather than one that was designed to be skewed from the get-go to benefit one particular party and punish another.
Justin Levitt, professor at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. Professor, thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Stephen Cifra spent 2 decades in and out of jail, including 8 years in solitary confinement. He's now a grad student at UC Berkeley in California, and he mentors other formerly incarcerated students through a program called Underground Scholars. Now, Stephen had a lot of challenges after getting out of detention, but one of the biggest and simplest was simply how to be kinder to himself.
I'm really hard on myself a lot, and, you know, it's an academic mental exercise to figure out why I shouldn't do that, but if you live in self-loathing, you can read all the books you want on self-compassion. It doesn't add up to anything. So I don't have a lot of self-compassion, but it's a skill like any other.
Stephen is this week's guinea pig for the new podcast, The Science of Happiness. For his happiness challenge, Stephen chose the self-compassionate letter.
So I wrote a letter to me as if I wasn't me, but if I was somebody else who I was mentoring, what I would say to somebody who had this problem. And I am a mentor to some people, so I have a little bit of experience talking people down.
Dacher Keltner is back with us now. Dacher is host of the Science of Happiness podcast. He explains how Stephen's experiment went and what the science tells us about being kind and compassionate to yourself.
One of the, you know, the interesting things that's happening in the United States is we have over 2 million people in prison, and a lot of them are going to be leaving. And at UC Berkeley, we have a group called the Underground Scholars, who are 20 to 30 students who are incarcerated and now are making the difficult transition to getting a degree at UC Berkeley. And Stephen was part of the foundation of that group, and he grew up in a really tough family in Southern California and started leaving school at age 9 or 10, got into drugs, hard drugs at age 13, started stealing stuff to support the habit. And then regrettably, like a lot of adolescents who are cast into the criminal justice system, you know, started going to various forms of detention, I think at age 14 or so, which included a lot of solitary confinement. And the entire society, from teachers to people representing the law, was coming at him full force with criticism and condemnation and humiliation. So his mind is a minefield of humiliating voices. And as he tried this exercise of self-compassion, which is where you just take the perspective of somebody who says kind things about you upon your own foibles and struggles and failures, he called to mind this really important teacher in his life, a teacher of Shakespeare, this older guy, and just the things that he would say that supported Stephen. And, you know, we know from work by like Naomi Eisenberger down at UCLA, when we hear supportive language from people we care about, these networks in the brain that are associated with physical safety are activated. So it kind of called forth this feeling of safety and belongingness in Stephen.
Well, one of the things that Stephen did for your happiness exercise as the happiness guinea pig was take on that voice of the friend instead of the critic. Let's listen to Stephen taking on the voice of a friend in this experiment.
You are not inadequate. The fact is, everyone feels scared at some point in their lives. Most people feel inadequate at times. That you experience these feelings daily, constantly, and can still show up for your family and community and for yourself is a more accurate measure of who you are. People are not defined by their feelings or actions. But if you must know yourself as something, you should know that you are as deserving of feeling okay as anyone. You are as qualified to take credit for your life as anyone. Sure, you and your benefits and resources, even internal resources, are derived from the past efforts of others. So then say that. Say to yourself and to those unfortunates who try to compliment you, thank you. You could have chosen differently.
What is Stephen doing here from the perspective of the science of happiness?
Well, you know, we know that compassion produces all these amazing effects on the body. And what's happening with self-compassion, where Stephen says, he takes this voice of the teacher and, you know, he says, hey, you're not inadequate. It's okay to feel fear. And, you know, Stephen at one point in the episode talks about getting let out of a detention center and he sleeps in a dumpster, right? And he's a young guy just drifting, lots of fear. That he's not defined by those feelings, that it's okay to be kind and think of the good things that he's doing. That orients all these powerful effects on the brain and body of compassion to the self, which we often don't do. And it puts you into this more accepting state of, you know, Stephen did some bad stuff in his life. But he's doing pretty well right now with his family and his school. So I have been surprised at how powerful an exercise this quieting of the inner critic is.
Well, you bring on experts for every episode, Dacher. This episode, you brought on Serena Chen. She's a professor of psychology at Berkeley. Let's hear from Professor Chen and then talk about what might be going on here below the surface.
So what the study shows is, in a real behavioral concrete way, is that when people treat themselves compassionately in the face of failure, they're actually motivated to do better the next time.
Yeah, you know, what's really important in this science, Todd, is to get to rigorous experimental data. And so Serena has done these really wonderful lab studies where she has people kind of think kindly toward the self from another person's perspective, self-compassion, or just think good thoughts about the self, sort of a self-affirmation control condition. And she finds that being kind to the self, as she says, recognizing we make mistakes, everybody does, part of humanity, kind of energizes people. And they go after their goals with a little bit more verve. They want to make amends for mistakes they've made out in the world. They, you know, feel like they can improve themselves. And, you know, the critical voice and all the condemnation that's contained within it kind of incapacitates people. It puts them in this state of doubt and fear. And I think self-compassion frees people of that.
Well, you have an N of one here with Stephen Sifra. What did he say about how his own experimentation on himself made him feel and made him perform?
He said at one point, you know, you're not defined by your feelings. You know, and that is such a deep insight that, you know, somebody like Stephen, you know, and he talked about this, like, you know, he would recall the coldness from his mother and the aggression that was in his family and felt that. And he said, you know, that's not who you are. That's just part of your past. It's part of this history that he's living.
I had a rough going and that I didn't get what I had coming to me, which was care and security and the kinds of things we give children. And that had an effect on me that is going to be a part of me for the rest of my life. And that I can, in understanding that, I can, I guess, give myself a break.
And then I think that there was also this sense that Stephen talked about he is not inadequate, that the deep voices in his mind, really coming from early in childhood, before he can remember, were telling him he was worthless. And yet a lot of things in his life, he's paying his bills, he's raising kids, he's in a family, He's going to Berkeley as a grad student. We're saying, you know, you're doing pretty well. And it just gave him this sense of he's okay. So that's a pretty good achievement for a life that Stephen has led.
Dacher Keltner, host of the Science of Happiness podcast, co-produced by the Greater Good Science Center and PRI. Dacher, always a pleasure.
It's great to be with you, Todd.
You can find out how to write a self-compassionate letter on our website at thetakeaway.org. Next week, the science of laughter and whether it's good medicine or actually the best. You know, you could go through all the signs of happiness, or you could really just win a gold medal.
It's gold!
Overnight, the U.S. women's hockey team came from behind to beat Canada in a shootout, the first gold medal since 1998, and you don't need science to guess how happy they must be right now and how happy we are for them. Thanks so much for listening. Congratulations, USA. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.